Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor, the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In May 2024, I spoke to author and journalist for Slate Magazine and Phelan US Center Visiting Senior Fellow, Fred Kaplan. Fred Kaplan is the National Security Columnist for Slate and author of six books, including The Bomb, The Insurgents, and The Wizards of Armageddon. He was a member of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for a special Boston Globe Sunday magazine on the nuclear arms race. We spoke about his 2020 book, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War, and about the changing attitudes of U.S. politicians and policymakers to nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Well, thank you so much for joining us on The Ballpark. It's great to have you here.
Sure, great to be here.
Just to begin with, could you briefly introduce your work? If you could talk about your main areas of interest as a writer and journalist and what draws you to them. Thank you.
Well, for about 20 years, I've been the national security columnist for Slate. Before that, I spent 20 years as a newspaper reporter for the Boston Globe, first as its defense reporter, then as its Moscow bureau chief during early Yeltsin, 92 to 95, then New York bureau chief. During all this time, I've also done a lot of freelancing. I've written six books and write about other things on the side that are completely different, like movies, jazz, hi-fi equipment, art, that sort of thing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So recently you spoke at LSE for a Phelan US Center event exploring whether the risk of nuclear war is increasing. Could you tell us about your view on this question and what you've feel are the main sources of this risk?
Yeah, I would say nobody really knows whether it's increasing. And anybody who says definitively whether it is or isn't is kidding himself. You know, if you go back to the early 60s, late 50s, if you had told anybody who studied this very closely at the time that, hey, you know, over the next 65 years, there will not be a single instance when anybody uses nuclear weapons in a war, they would think you were crazy. It was thought as being almost inevitable that this would happen. Why it hasn't happened? I mean, there are several reasons for that. Various countries have developed more conventional weapons, so they don't have to use nukes even to go into a serious war. A lot of it is deterrence, you know. You don't beat me up or I'll beat you up. This is a rather compelling argument. And there's also a bit of luck. You know, there have been cases of false missile alerts, things like that. They tend to happen at moments when there isn't a big crisis going on, so nobody quite believes it. One danger is what happens if there's somebody in charge who doesn't think through things very well, and there's an accident, and it's during a crisis. The other possibility is if more and more countries get nuclear weapons for whatever reason, and there's a lot of reasons. For example, they might no longer believe in the U.S. deterrent, the U.S. commitment, U.S. reliability to the alliance. And if then their opponent gets nuclear weapons and they don't have enough time to develop kind of patterns of behavior, really good early warning systems, tight permissive action links, then I think there is a case to be made that the more countries that have nuclear weapons, especially if they don't have these institutional barriers, the greater likelihood of say, an accidental nuclear war.
Thank you so much for that. So in 2020, you published the book, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Can you talk a bit about the main insights from that book and how you reflect on those insights might have changed in how you view the risk of nuclear war in the world of today?
Well, one insight that, I like to think there are several, but one that kind of surprised me a bit is that there have been more instances than I'd previously thought and that is generally understood when presidents, American presidents, have generally considered the use of using nuclear weapons in a crisis. And in those occasions, they have really looked into it pretty deeply, studied the strategic options, probed the scenarios, and they've all come to the conclusion that there is no victory to be had here, and that I need to start digging my way out of this rabbit hole through diplomatic or other means as quickly as possible. So that, you know, that's an assuring lesson. Now, you know, the question is whether we'll always have presidents who look deeply into such issues. That's a question that's been tested more recently. But the other thing is that even to the present day, nuclear weapons continue to play a greater role in foreign policy and in calculations of risk than is often thought. I mean, back in the late 50s, early 60s, even into the 70s, if there was a major war, the Western world sort of relied on nuclear weapons, didn't have much of a conventional defense. But even now, when there is a conventional defense, nuclear weapons are still a major thing. I mean, for example, President Obama, when he was in the White House, he chaired two NSC discussions, pretty deep, on whether the U.S. should declare a no first use policy. And during the course of these discussions, he himself said that he cannot imagine, in fact, any president using nuclear weapons first. And he would turn to like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and, you know, do you agree with me on that, general? And he'd say, yeah, I do. But he stopped short of declaring this as policy for fear that allies would get bent out of shape, because they are still relying on what's called the extended deterrent. The idea that with deterrence being, if you clobber me, I clobber you. Extended deterrence is I'm extending this to you, my ally, my important ally. Countries of NATO, Japan, a few others. And any time that a president has given even the slightest clue that he might be backing away from this, panic ensues. So it is still, even though it might not be at the center of everyday considerations about defense policy, it is still at the center of kind of the big picture of balance of power, of risks of war, of who you can trust, that sort of thing.
Thank you. So how would you say U.S. politicians' and policymakers' attitudes towards nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament changed since the end of the Cold War, and perhaps more recently in response to the conflicts in Ukraine, the Middle East, and the potential for conflict between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, it's, you know, right after the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of thinking that, we can really do a lot of disarmament here. And in fact, some of the arms control treaties that have truly reduced the size and risks of the arsenals have been signed since what you might call, well, the end of the Soviet Union, certainly, the end of the Cold War, New START being the most recent. Ever since Russia especially started getting more aggressive, particularly with the annexation of Crimea, invasion of Georgia, subsequently, of course, the invasion of Ukraine, there is no appetite whatsoever for not only for reducing nuclear weapons, but for putting any kind of brakes on. Well, right now, the United States is, quote unquote, modernizing all three legs of the nuclear triad, the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, the submarines and their missiles, the bombers carry, the I-Cruise missiles. This is costing about $50 billion a year, and that's just in the development phase. It's going to end up costing a couple of trillion over 30 years at a time when the rest of the budget is pinched. And there is no resistance to this whatsoever. And you know, when COVID first started and people were thinking, oh, we have to spend, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars for economic revival and protection, There was a brief moment when people thought, well, you know, maybe we should, people in Congress, I got calls after my book came out, even from Republicans, a couple of Republicans whose names you would recognize, saying, you know, we've kind of taken our eye off the ball when it comes to oversight of nuclear stuff. And I think we ought to start doing this. Would you come in and talk to our committee? Okay, then Putin pulls, I forget exactly what move it was, and that was the end of it. No more. So it's, all of it is just theatrics at this point. And the entire defense budget, I mean, there used to be a time when even hawks among on the staff of the Armed Services Committee, they would go through a line item assessment of the budget. You know, do we really need this program? Is this program duplicative with that program? Does this really work? You know, they don't do any of that. They just approve the entire thing and then raise it some more. And nobody even asks, how much do we really need for the nuclear weapons? Nobody says, do we really need to match all the stupid things that Russia and China are doing? What do we have these nuclear weapons for? How many do you need to do that? I mean, these are kind of basic questions. You know, anybody studying at LSE, this kind of thing, you know, this is one of the, these are the kinds of questions that you'd look at in the first semester. These questions aren't even on the board anymore. Maybe a handful of people ask it, and it's just to keep the issue alive. There's no pretense that anybody's going to cut a dime from any nuclear weapons project. So yeah, it has become, you know, I mean, not to deny that Russia or China pose threats and even nuclear threats, but the idea of, well, what do we do about it, isn't even a question that anybody seriously asks, which is, you know, a shame. One likes to go through programs like this thinking that, well, I'm going to now be dealing with issues that people in power out there really deal with. And maybe they will again someday, but right now they're not.
Thank you. I just want to kind of dig into that a bit more in a kind of historical context. Reading your book, I was struck by, certainly in the 60s and 70s, the disconnect which you put forward, that the president often thought one thing about nuclear weapons and a lot of the defense establishment thought another and was making different plans that the president was sort of signing off on, but maybe not being as aware. To what extent does the leadership differ from the defense establishment, the military establishment now, or are they in more lockstep in terms of nuclear war planning and nuclear war preparation compared to maybe the 60s and 70s?
Well, even in the 60s and 70s, maybe not the 60s, but certainly starting in the 70s and 80s, 90s, the last thing most presidents wanted to do was to spend a day going into the nuclear war scenarios and the planning and all that. It's unpleasant, right? You know, B, the people, those who had thought about it thought it was a lot of nonsense. In fact, you know, every year there is a war game. You know, you pretend that there's a nuclear attack. What do you do about it? You rehearse making sure everybody's in on the phone call with the SAC commander, with the STRATCOM commander. Everybody can be called into the same room. And usually in these games, like a senior cabinet guy plays the president and junior cabinet people play the senior cabinet members. The only president whoever played the president in one of these war games, and he did it twice, was Jimmy Carter, who, you know, is being, this is a guy who publicly said that nuclear weapons were evil, okay? His attitude was, in fact, he was startled. He was amazed that he'd been the first president to play one of these games. He's thinking, you know, if I ever have to do something like this, it's going to be the most consequential, existential thing any president could do. He was also the first president to bring the vice president into the process. And he was stunned that this hadn't happened before, because, you know, the White House could get blown up. And then what? Then what? So the vice president, and he also had surprise alerts. You know, his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, would, like, at Friday at 9 o'clock, put out the word, okay, nuclear warning, and then everybody, all the people who are supposed to be in on this phone call, are supposed to get to a secure phone line. Well, the first couple of times he tried this, it was a disaster. You know, it took hours to find it. Then people said, okay, this guy's serious about this. So it's something that you would think a president would take a lot more seriously, but most of them don't. I do say, though, it's true that, as I said, when a real crisis happens, most of them have started asking very serious questions. But I mean, even someone like President Kennedy, who got to be very knowledgeable in this during the Berlin crisis, when of the fall of 1961, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were some scenarios where we launch a handful of missiles to Russia. And he wrote out a series of questions. And it's clear that he actually wrote out these questions, because one of the questions was, if I launch a missile, do I have any power to call it back? And no advisor who knew anything would dare to ask, because of course the answer is no. No, you can't. But he didn't know that. He wasn't sure about that himself. So the intricacies of nuclear war planning are highly contrasted with what, and we can't even just talk about presidents, even senior officials, except for those who dwell in this world morning, noon, and night, which is of increasingly small number of people, actually. No, they don't pay a lot of attention to it, which is one reason why I wrote this book. I wrote a book back in the early 80s called The Wizards of Armageddon, about the people who invented nuclear strategy and how it got translated into policy. When Trump was elected president and started talking rather irresponsibly about nuclear weapons, I realized, a lot of people weren't even alive when I wrote that first book. And those who were have chosen to forget about nuclear weapons. You know, we went through the holiday from history, as some call it, after the Cold War. And so people need to be reminded of what this is about. Plus, I knew there was a lot of updating that I needed to do, not only with what had happened since 1983, but documents had been declassified, even of the earlier things, which I didn't have access to at the time. So, yeah, I was hoping one role of this book would be to say, hey, here's the history. Here's how it happened that we all developed thousands of nuclear weapons. Here are the plans that have been considered for how to use them. And here's how it's played out in the eyes of presidents and generals and admirals.
Thank you. And do you think we're now nearly at 80 years since nuclear weapons were used in anger? Do you think that's a factor in terms of the nuclear weapons have such a place in people's popular imaginations? Do you think we still have the ability to conceive of what a nuclear war would be like? Or has that been perhaps lost given the amount of time and how different weapons are now compared to 1945?
Yeah, I think there's a scholar at Brown University who talked about a nuclear taboo. And I think there is a nuclear taboo. In other words, even as we've now developed atomic weapons that are quote unquote low yield. Now, even that phrase has to be put in perspective. In the old days we had H bombs of megaton range, you know, the equivalent of millions of tons of TNT plus all the radiation, fallout, EMP, and all that. Then it became hundreds of kilotons. So these low yield nuclear weapons are still about 8 kilotons. The bomb that destroyed most of Hiroshima was 12 and a half kilotons. So we're still talking about, the bombs that you see, that we've used in Iraq, that Israel has used sometimes in Gaza, these are 2,000 pounds. These are 1-ton bombs. I'm talking about 8,000 tons, and that is a low-yield nuclear weapon. So we're still talking about the level of destruction and releasing of energy that almost nobody has seen, nobody who's alive has ever seen. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who deal in this world who speak very cavalierly about nuclear weapons and nuclear exchanges. And they talk about, you know, ladders of escalation. And yeah, you can get so accustomed to these scenarios, which are written in books and done on computer programs, that you forget for a moment that, wait a minute, nobody's ever actually done this. Nobody, in fact, has the slightest idea what will happen after the first exchange of these. This idea that, you know, oh, we it's like a chessboard. We move the knight, and then the Russians move the bishop, and then pawn takes, you know, rook takes pawn or what. And then this just kind of keeps going back and forth in a very controlled way with the chess masters, looking down at the board and knowing what's going on. In fact, it could well be that after a few nuclear weapons go off, satellite communications, GPS, might be completely destroyed. We might not have the slightest idea what's going on. Has this city been destroyed? I don't know. Is this military base still there? I don't know, sir. The phones are all out. We've lost computer communication. Nobody has the slightest idea. The notion that, deterrence is a funny thing. Let's back up a minute. In the old days, it was, it was really massive retaliation. You know, the Russians, invade West Germany, and the plan in 1960 was to shoot off all of our nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union, China, even if China didn't have a part in the war, because it was thought that the Soviet Union and China were the same thing, and all the military targets in Eastern Europe, killing, a few hundred million people. Okay, then late 50s, early 60s, when the Russians started developing their own arsenal, people said, oh, wait a minute. I mean, if they invade Germany, then we clobber them with our nuclear weapons. They're going to clobber us with their nuclear weapons, which means that we're talking about something that, isn't terribly moral, but also might not be credible. Are we really going to do this? Are we going to commit suicide? And so people started coming up with limited nuclear options. Well, maybe we can just attack their military targets, telling them if you fire back, then we're going to kill your cities. And then as the technology advanced, these options got more and more limited to the point where you could maybe, quote unquote, fight a nuclear war. And so what happened was, it got to the point where the idea of nuclear deterrence and nuclear war fighting weren't opposites, they were parallels. Nuclear war fighting was a dimension of credible nuclear deterrence. And that's when people started taking because you have to give the impression that you believe this. The whole idea of deterrence is you have to convey to the enemy that you are really going to do this. Otherwise, it's not a deterrent. He doesn't believe you. So in order to really to give the impression you were really going to do this, you have to convince not only the other guy, you have to convince yourself. And you have to develop weapons and plans and maybe even do exercises that indicate that you believe it yourself. And so what happens after a while is that you might actually begin to believe it yourself. Until a president comes along who's completely unfamiliar with any of this, and he gets a whiff of one of these briefings, delivered in very confident tones by some one-star general or something. And most of the presidents who've done this, they look at this and they say, this is what's been going on. Oh my God, this is crazy. I've got to get out of this crisis. So the hope is that presidents and other countries' presidents have the same reaction. I'm more worried about other countries' presidents, quite honestly.
So in the 1960s, public concerns about nuclear war were high in the context of high-profile events like the Cuban Missile Crisis. How worried is the public about nuclear war now?
I think it comes and goes. I mean, when Trump was first president and the North Koreans were testing, they were on the verge of testing ICBMs. They were testing a lot of missiles, starting to test even some nuclear explosives. He said that, not if North Korea attacked us, but if they continued to test these weapons, they will, receive the kind of damage that nobody has ever seen before. And this was practically a quote of how Harry Truman described the bombing of Hiroshima. And that got a lot of people's attention. And people were worried for a while. And at the time, there was some debate over whether we really should continue to fund this new generation of missiles. We had a Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, who was a Marine general. Marines don't have nuclear weapons. So he'd been to Stanford and had been educated by some arms control people. He thought maybe we could do away with the land-based ICBMs altogether. Well, that idea got punted. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the latest opinion poll. Also, a lot of these questions, they depend how it's asked. I think that there's genuine worry about, what if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? What if North Korea develops the ability to put a nuclear weapon on an ICBM? But I don't know. There's a lot of, even back in the 60s, and I'm old enough to remember the days when, there would be fallout drills. You would duck and cover. You would get under your desk and put your arms over your head in case there was a nuclear blast. And I, by the way, I lived about 100 miles from a SAC base, so it wasn't an abstract concern. And this was around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, but it was a joke. Even at least we kids thought it was a joke. I don't know what the parents thought, the teachers. And of course, there was the movie Dr. Strangelove in 64, which, it was a satire. It was a comedy. It was a black comedy. It was something you could laugh about, but that also means to laugh away. I think if you really thought, in your heart of hearts, that there was going to be a nuclear war, say in the next 5 years, you might be living your life a little differently. One thing I said in the book, Daniel Ellsberg, before he became an anti-nuclear guy and anti-war, he was a pretty Cold War hawk. He went to work in the Rand Corporation. It was 1960. He was 29 years old. Rand offered a very generous life insurance policy. He didn't take it. He didn't sign up for it. Neither did a couple of his colleagues, because he figured that he would never collect. That sometime before he died, there would be a nuclear war and he would be killed by it. So what's the point of signing up for that? That's kind of like putting your money where your mouth is, right? Look, there's a lot of things. There is so much out there now that we've all learned to be in a state of denial about, global warming, nuclear war. I mean, there are several of them. Now we have changed our lifestyle somewhat on nuclear warming. We get higher mileage cars, or don't take cars as much, or we recycle, or the environmental thing has kind of seeped into us quite a bit, but not that much. Not that much. And nuclear war, I guess you could say to yourself, there's really not much I can do about this anyway. And so why burden myself with thinking about it a lot either? And by the way, I don't even, if you haven't read my book or other books like it, you might not even know where or how to begin to think about it, other than just crawling into a corner and getting into the fetal position and becoming very paranoid, which is no way to live your life either. So yeah, now, again, if there ever is something like a Cuban Missile Crisis where the president goes on TV and says our missiles are on alert, then, you might all of a sudden start thinking about it a lot. But it's one of these things that you don't have to get your head around to go about your life. And I think that makes a big difference. Now, the people who really should think about this more are people in Congress who just blithely pass, the defense budget now in the U.S. is nearly $1 trillion. And $50 billion of that is in nuclear weapons. Now, I guess you could say, well, that's only 5%, but it's $50 billion. That's a hell of a lot of money that could be used even for other things, shortcomings in defense, much less in other needs that we all have.
Are there other areas of the world that you feel are underreported and pose significant danger in terms of nuclear threat? You've talked about some potential places like Iran, for example.
Yeah. Well, underreported, I mean, it depends. I mean, I don't know if they're underreported. I mean, I think, it is true that in the U.S. anyway, it's very hard for the news media, especially television, to focus on more than one foreign story at a time. So, you know, for a while, Ukraine was like front page, top of the news every day. Well, the situation in Ukraine hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's gotten, from the Ukrainians' point of view, worse. And yet it's been shoved off the front page by what's going on with Israel and Gaza. Very rare are the days when you see both of them getting front page news. Therefore, you know, if Iran was suddenly on the verge of going nuclear, I mean, that's two other foreign stories that it's got to penetrate to get a front page story. I mean, I saw the other day in the Financial Times, they'd interviewed the head of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, who said, well, it looks to me like, who's been very critical of things that Iran has done, looks to me like Iran might be ready for renewed talks on nuclear weapons. I don't know. To me, that's a pretty big story. I didn't see it reported at all in American newspapers. I don't know beyond the FT how much it was even here. So I don't know what's underreported. I mean, I don't know. I guess everything is to some degree underreported. I mean, people talk about all the civilians that Israel has killed in Gaza, but, you know, I don't know. Nobody seems to talk about the 500,000 Syrians that Assad has killed, or the hundreds of thousands dead in the Congo, or the more than 1 million Afghans that the Pakistanis have ordered back into Afghanistan. I mean, there's horrors going on all over the place. In terms of what might lead to a nuclear war, well, yes or no, Iran is certainly an issue, but we don't really know what leads to a nuclear war. I mean, for example, there is a school of thought among realists, international realists, that nuclear proliferation is a good thing. If everybody had nuclear weapons, then everybody's deterring each other. And nuclear weapons, you know, they can deter not only nuclear wars, but conventional wars too. So, yeah, that's a good thing. On the other hand, I'm more with the latter group here, you don't know how responsibly some new nuclear power, especially if it's run by North Koreans or Iranian mullahs, will really handle this. At the same time, you know, there was a pretty high, kind of upper mid-level official during the Trump administration in the Pentagon, dealt with nuclear weapons. I went to interview him once, and he said, you know, I would say there is less of a chance of the U.S. getting into a nuclear war under Trump than was the case under Obama. And I said, okay, I'll bite. How's that? He goes, well, if we get into a nuclear war, it's probably because we're coming to the aid of an ally, and Trump doesn't care about allies. So, okay, right? That makes sense. Now, to the extent that's true, it may be that other countries, some of our allies, decide they need nuclear weapons of their own. I mean, if Trump comes back in and he continues to talk about allies the way he was doing in his first term and as he has since, I can imagine South Korea saying, nah, we need to get our own nuclear weapons to deter China and North Korea. Japan, it would be a little tougher because they have a special stigma about nuclear weapons, having been the only country to be ravaged by them. Nonetheless, if they wanted to, they certainly have the technical capability to develop nuclear weapons very quickly, as does South Korea, by the way. Then if they do that, I can see, you know, North Korea building more, China building more, you know, arms races going on. If Iran builds nuclear weapons, you know, Saudi Arabia very much wants to have a security arrangement with the United States where we provide them with peaceful nuclear technology. If we ever do get into that, I can see them converting to nuclear weapons. which they say they would need as a deterrent against Iran. So I see a world of two figure numbers of countries having nuclear weapons to be very perilous.
And for my last question, given that you've just talked about the risks of proliferation, what steps could be taken to mitigate the risk of nuclear war?
Nuclear war or nuclear proliferation? Two different things.
I'm going to say, what steps could be taken to mitigate the risks of nuclear war?
Well, again, some of them we're already doing. I mean, maintaining a reliable deterrent. I mean, we spend a lot of money on that, more than I think we need to. But look, why hasn't Iran gotten into this war more heavily? Why haven't they really unloaded on Israel with weapons? Or why haven't they let Hezbollah do that? Well, one reason, I think, is that the United States has a couple of aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean and said that they put at least one of them there for the purpose of deterring Iran from doing that. And the other, Israel has, they never talk about this, but everybody knows they have a couple hundred nuclear weapons, some of them on submarines that can't be targeted, some of them on bombers that can get off the ground quickly and, as we've recently rediscovered, can easily penetrate Iranian air defense radar. So that's a substantial deterrent. I think, part of deterrence, as I said, is convincing the other guy that you will really use these things if necessary. The danger comes when you get so adept at appearing to, that you're able and willing to use them, that people think you might really use them, and that sets into motion preemptive pressures. If we're in a crisis, if you and I are locked in a crisis, and we both have nuclear weapons, and I think that you really are about to use it because of something that you said, I might launch my first strike before you launch your first strike, because it's better to do that than to just take the second strike. That's the danger. And so one thing I think that is necessary is that even if you're just irreconcilable enemies with each other, having lines of communication are very important. I mean, for a while, the US and China, no communications, even military to military communication. Right now, they're back on, and that's good. I think they need to. A friend of mine who used to be in the CIA told me that actually he thought moles were a good thing. If you have a mole inside another country's government, he can report back, hey, you know what? These guys really aren't in the mood to attack us. And it can reduce tensions. I think talking about anything. I mean, for a long time during the Cold War, the most useful thing about arms control treaties, which, again, until recently didn't lower the number of nuclear weapons at all, was that it created these forums where officials from both the U.S. and the Soviet Union met periodically to discuss issues of disagreement or ambiguity. And this itself was what they called confidence-building measures. Even with Russia, I mean, we're not in any kind of talking mood with Russia right now, but there is still this one office that's open where we're discussing possible prisoner trades. That's something, I don't think we should be doing any diplomacy with Putin right now. It's untrustworthy. But I find it uncomfortable that the Russians pulled out of all the verification procedures on the New START treaty. They're not allowing U.S. officials to go inspect sites anymore. We can learn enough through satellites and things like that. But one of the strong things about New START was that it was very, very intrusive inspection procedures on both sides. That's not happening anymore. And there also was a consultative commission where there are ambiguities. Are you doing this? It looks like you're doing that. Is it for this? Those haven't met for quite a long time either. And I think that's very dangerous. A lot of threats in the old days came from thinking about worst case scenarios. And it's very easy to come up with hair-raising worst case scenarios. You know, there were guys in the late 50s before photo reconnaissance satellites, there'd be a U2 photo of, like, I don't know, an agricultural silo. And they would say, you know, there could be a missile in there. Or see this big ditch, it's big. There could be an I. They could be setting up a launch control center for an ICBM there. So anything that you can do that can offer reassurances, not false reassurances, but genuine reassurances on worst case scenarios is prima facie a very good thing. So if that's all we can do at the moment, I think that's a very big move.
Thank you. And just before we finished, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about any upcoming projects you're working on, you want to promote, or anything else you'd like to our listeners to know about.
Well, you know, I have a regular column in Slate. I'm not doing quite as many of them during the month that I'm here in London, but on generally I do 2 a week on average. It's called the War Stories column. And although it's not coming out for a while, you might just want to write down, I'm soon going to be coming out with a novel called A Capital Calamity, which is kind of half satire, half thriller about a cynical defense consultant who, through one of his acts of mischief, nearly begins World War III. So I don't know when that's coming out, but mark it down, keep on the lookout for it.
Something for our listeners to look out for. Fred Kaplan, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Sure, thank you.
Fred Kaplan is author and journalist for Slate Magazine and a Phelan U.S. Center Visiting Senior Fellow. Check out our show notes for links to his War Stories column at Slate Magazine and to a podcast of the April 30th, 2024 panel event with the Phelan U.S. Center he took part in, Is the Risk of Nuclear War Increasing? And that's it for this extra inning of the Ballpark. Thanks so much to Fred Kaplan for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. Look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And please, tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.